This is the web stream of KBOO Portland. KBOO is 100% community supported. If you have not yet become a member, go to the website kboo.fm and click on the tip jar.
It was opened up everywhere in the West and Alaska. Chinese men took over mines abandoned by white miners.
America represented opportunities, economic opportunities for them.
Ronald Takaki, professor of ethnic studies at the University of California, Berkeley.
But they wanted to settle here, and 50% or more of them who came here were already married, and so they had left wives behind. America did not want these Chinese workers to bring wives and children with them and to settle in America. Essentially, they saw the Chinese as temporary workers.
When the gold mining ran out, American businessmen found other uses for these hardworking men.
But what was the American West for Chinese immigrants? It was the gold rush, California. It was also building the railroad. The superintendent of the Central Pacific Railroad, which had a workforce that was 90% Chinese, the superintendent, Charles Crocker, in testimony before Congress, said, "We want these men to come over here, work for the railroad temporarily, and then return to China." He said, "We don't want them bringing their wives over here, settling in America and becoming thick," and he used that word, thick. Essentially, there was this view, powerful view, a pervasive view, that the United States should be a white man's country. And so the Chinese were welcomed as workers, but not welcomed as settlers.
Chinese men built the western half of the Transcontinental Railroad. In spite of this contribution, these immigrants faced discrimination and violence throughout the frontier. In 1885, a mob of white coal miners killed 28 of their Chinese co-workers in Rock Springs, Wyoming, and burned down 79 Chinese homes, causing hundreds of Chinese residents to flee. In 1887, in the Snake River Massacre, 30 Chinese miners were murdered near the Oregon-Idaho border. Chinese immigrants were only welcome as long as their labor was needed. After the American Civil War, widespread economic depression forced many to the West to find work. Chinese workers were becoming more and more unwelcome. But in the dry sagebrush hills of eastern Oregon, in the small town of John Day, a thriving Chinatown emerged, thanks in large part to a doctor named Ing Hay. He was a herbalist and acupuncturist who became known as Doc Hay. His medical practice was located in a general store named the Kamwa Chung. Chapter 2 of Frontier Asians, Doc Hay, Frontier Herbalist, by D. May Roberts.
It was after the railroad had been built, after the Civil War is over. It's the beginning of not only anti-Chinese sentiment, but anti-Chinese violence and then anti-Chinese laws.
But because Oregon was still a frontier, Chinese labor was welcome.
This is where Doc Hay would come and fix your herbs and medicines.
They carried this lady into the house because she couldn't walk and took him back to the treatment room and worked for, I think, maybe about an hour. And doggone it, this lady didn't walk out of there.
The story of Ing Doc Hay is full of medical miracles. This Chinese herbalist was the closest thing to a doctor on the eastern Oregon frontier.
"Doctor, sir, you have been recommended as a first-class doctor, and as there is no doctor here that can do me any good, I would like to know what you think about my case."
Ing Hay would then prescribe packets of herbs and dictate instructions for his business partner, Lung On, to write in English. In 1882, two young immigrants from China came to the dry sagebrush hills of eastern Oregon at the end of the gold rush. Ing Hay was a doctor of acupuncture and an herbalist. His friend and partner, Lung On, was an educated businessman with a penchant for wheeling and dealing. 5 years after they arrived, they bought a general store and began curing patients near and far. Their story is not well known, but the Kamwa Chung building with its dark, smoke-stained interior and distinct odor of herbal remedies still stands today as a museum.
We do know that opium smoking was done in the building because it was legal till 1909.
Ying He came from the Guangdong province of China, where the British Opium Wars and repeated agricultural failures contributed to another rebellion during the 1860s, in which as many as 30 million Chinese died. Many of those who escaped death and poverty came to America during the Gold Rush.
You really have to go back to the events of the late Gold Rush.
Jeffrey Barlow, professor of history at Pacific University.
Once gold was discovered, then that began bringing in a great many Chinese workers. There was a period in the 19th century, as strange as it may seem, when Chinese were actually the dominant ethnic group in both Idaho and eastern Oregon.
But after the Civil War and the economic depression that followed, there was a strong anti-Chinese sentiment and anti-Chinese laws throughout the West, leading to the passage of the Chinese Exclusion Act of 1882. The act was in effect till 1943, when China became an ally to America during World War II. Newspapers of the time depicted Chinese people in highly negative images. They were the Yellow Peril, a threat to white America and the labor unions. This led to the passing of many exclusionary laws. But once immigration was almost stopped, some people began to see the remaining Chinese as an endangered asset. An article from the Grant County News of December 1888.
Stockmen say that since the Chinese exclusion bill became a law, Chinamen are scarce, and therefore warn all parties not to kill Mongolians in their employ, or they will be prosecuted to the full extent of the law.
Now, the reason they had all filtered down to John Day as a community was that other communities had become very violent.
Jeffrey Barlow.
Oregon really was the last frontier. By this period, the great cattle drives are over, Texas is being settled, the Mexican-American War has been fought out. Other areas of the country are relatively settled, but Oregon was still very wild. It had its own Western culture. We don't speak of cowboys. Our cowboys are buckaroos. And there was, in that part of eastern Oregon with the Gold Rush, it was still an extremely violent area.
From 1880 to 1900, there were about 10,000 Chinese residents in Oregon. Most were miners. The rest were ranch hands and laborers.
But because Oregon was still a frontier, Chinese labor was welcome. Labor unions in this period were sort of adopting the American ethnic flag, white ethnicity, as a means of building support. But the mayor simply locked these people up. There was going to be no nonsense in Oregon of this kind of racial violence. And that was because the area was an underpopulated frontier, and we were much more concerned about having the labor available than we were taking a look at the color of the men and women who were doing it. On the frontier, race is a lot less important than you might think. I think race is more important in the towns and cities than it is out in the countryside or on the ranches. What we found was the main concern of the people in this area was really an answer to one simple question: can you do your job? Can you be relied upon? Are you a man or a woman who will stick? And the Chinese were, so this was the work that they wound up doing, and in John Day, they were welcome.
Gum wa chung, gum gold, wa blossom chung, prosperity, gum wa chung.
The Kam Wah Chung building was closed down in 1955. The building, with much of its contents intact, was forgotten for more than two decades. In the 1970s, John Day officials trying to buy land nearby discovered that the city owned it. Jeffrey Barlow and Christine Richardson were the first scholars to help piece together the puzzle of Ing Doc Hay's life.
Doc Hay was so valuable to the community that he was protected. So this is a man who was, to begin with, 19th century Chinese, which means not very tall, not very heavy. But if you can imagine a small, slight Chinese man who never really learned to speak English, Lung An had to interpret for him. His English was broken at best. It wasn't among his many talents. Living in that violent environment, the poor man, we have no evidence that he was frightened. I think he probably trusted in the spirits that he probably saw as protecting him in the area, but I would have been frightened. Most of us would have been frightened in that particular environment. And he lived in a building in the Kam Wah Chung after 1887 that had to serve as a kind of a fortification, because periodically buckaroos would get liquored up and go down and decide they were going to hoorah the Chinamen. So they would lock the shutters and stay.
Our front door, as you can see, was well locked, as well as a wooden bolt in it. Went across and the lock. It also was lined with metal, and our whole building is stone on the outside, as well as the doors were metal. These are heavy doors.
A small two-story house, the Kamwa Chung stands dark and claustrophobic. The floorboards creak and the walls are black from smoke. Carolyn Meisenheimer has been curator of the Kamwa Chung and Company Museum for almost 30 years.
We do have one bullet hole in the door. They say the Americans would shoot up Chinatown once in a while on Saturday night and have not a malicious time, but have a scaring time for the Chinese.
Part two of Doc Hay, Frontier Herbalist, when we come back.
Actors featured in this segment of Frontier Asians were Andre Alcala, Sam A. Mallory, Chung So, and Jim Chan. I'm Dimae Roberts. You're listening to an Asian Pacific American Heritage Month presentation of Stage and Studio, featuring the story of Ing Doc Hay, Frontier Herbalist, from the Peabody Award-winning Crossing East series. For more info, visit crossingeast.org or stageandstudio.org. You're listening to music by the Cantonese Folk Music Society of San Francisco and Wong Onyuan.
Gum wa chung, gum gold wa blossom chung, prosperity. Gum wa chung.
Lung On, Doc Hay's business partner, was the educated businessman and operated the general store. He sold bootleg whiskey during Prohibition and the first cars in eastern Oregon at the turn of the century. He was also an avid gambler and sold opium in the back room till it became illegal.
They did cook on the wood stove. Doc Hay, when he first started using his medicines, he cooked your herbs up for you and gave you the liquid, and then he started giving you the herbs and you did the cooking at home.
There's still a strong herbal smell in the Kamwa Chung. Ing Hay, a master of Chinese medicine, was sought out by people on the frontier where there were no hospital facilities or qualified doctors. He would often take patients when Western medicine had failed. Doc Hay offered hope to the desperate.
There's a tumor on the left side of my neck. Yeah, I would be so glad if you would reduce that, as the doctors are wanting to cut it out and I have such a dread of the knife.
He was a pulse doctor. He would not pick up anything with his right hand at all. He used his left hand. His right hand was his diagnosis hand, so that he would lay those fingers on your wrist and other pulses to read the internal state of your body.
Doctor, sir, I will tell you how I am, and then if you can cure me, I will come out there, or you can send me medicine through the mail.
They would prescribe by mail. There are many letters from people who had been in the area and had moved out or had heard of Doc Hay in one way or another, and they would write in, explain. Sometimes Lung On, we think, wrote back and asked a few more questions, and then Doc Hay sent herbs. Many of their recipes are takeout, if you will, a little sack with Lung An's careful handwriting telling you how to put these recipes together on your own stove.
Among the artifacts from the Kamwa Chung are pages and pages of prescriptions written in Chinese.
金狗二钱，加多银花三钱，当归一钱半。
This is where Doc Hay would come and fix your herbs and medicines. He had 500 different Chinese herbs on the shelf. We do know what 250 of the 500 are used for. Most of them would be in a form of a tea. You would get so many and boil it up and make your tea and then drink your tea according to his directions. Or you might have gotten some kind of animal parts, deer horns, turtle shell, might have been ground up into powder and put in your medicine. And some of them, the tins are square tin. They made the tins out of different things. And then you could have most any kind of thing.
I understand that there were some, I don't know whether it was prejudice or just some problems with the medical profession. They didn't like his practicing medicine and they tried to shut him down, but there were enough resident supporters that they knocked it down every time they brought it to court, and they never were able to get anything with that.
Ed Wall, the grandnephew of Ing Dok Hay, moved to John Day, Oregon in 1942 when he was in elementary school.
When we arrived, of course, he was blind, and he was alone. He had just lost his business partner, Lung On. And Dad, being a relative, felt obligated to go there and take care of him. And knowing some herbs from China, he very quickly took up the practice that Dok Hay had there. And with Dok Hay's expertise and his knowledge in reading Chinese, he read all the herbal books, and so he gradually took over Dok Hay's practice, and we took care of Dok Hay for several years there while he lived in John Day. But my remembrance of Dok Hay was, although he was blind, he knew everybody that came in. He would recognize their voice and just, ah, yes, he just identified the people just immediately.
His parents slept in the kitchen. He and his brother took the bunk beds that once were reserved for opium smoking.
Every time we sit down for dinner, instead of having a tablecloth, he'd just spread some newspaper, and that was a tablecloth. Then he'd have his pot of tea there always, of course, when people come in, they were offered a cup of tea and sit and visit a while.
Sometimes people would come to buy groceries, sometimes to pray at the Buddhist shrines Ing Hay had built, but usually it was the doctor they wanted to see.
He was the source of last resort, and oftentimes they were pleasantly surprised with cures. One winter afternoon, a party came in from Burns, Oregon. They carried this lady into the house because she couldn't walk and took him back to the treatment room and worked for, I think, maybe about an hour. And doggone it, this lady didn't walk out of there. And I was so impressed with that. I said, what did he do, you know? It was a complication of the flu or something like that that affected her nervous system. And that kind of results, immediate results, is hard to find anywhere else.
This was Dok Hay's bedroom. Actually, it was under this bed that they found the $23,000 worth of uncashed checks. And it was under that bed, of course, all those checks were found.
Part of the income was Dok Hay, for sure. I think, in a sense, their social network and protection was Dok Hay, because Hay was so valuable on the frontier as a doctor that nobody was going to permit anyone from outside to come in and shoot their China doctor full of holes. He was too valuable a guy. So for Lung On, being next to Dok Hay meant that he was safe. On the other hand, for Dok Hay, Lung An meant here is a man who can communicate, who can write, who can communicate with China, where the herbs came from, who knows how to invest money, who knows how to manipulate social organization of both the Chinese and the Americans. And they were simply a wonderful partnership.
I remember I was scared to death of the Chinese people because I'd never been around them.
Thelma Kite was 4 years old when her mom took her to Ing Hay for an ear infection.
The doctor would give me candy to try to get me over it, but I'd hide behind my mother's skirt and reach around to take the candy because I was, like I say, I was scared. But I remember being teased by relatives about the Chinese doctor giving me kisses, which was the candy kisses.
Ing Hay and Lung On never went back to China. The Exclusion Act of 1882 created a society of Chinese bachelors who can neither bring their wives here nor go home to their wives without risking deportation. Ing Hay and Lung On settled into their American life on the frontier. In 1887, the Chinatown in John Day was a thriving, independent community of 1,000. By 1940, fewer than 20 residents of Chinese descent lived in John Day. Ed Hua and his family stayed with Ing Hay till he could no longer walk.
And he loved his cigars, and he had a big soft chair in the front room there, and he'd sit there and smoke his cigar and fall asleep. But unfortunately, he fell and broke his hip, and that was his downfall. We had to bring him into Portland then and put him into a rest home where they could take care of him because it's just too much for Dad and Mom to take care of. And I think he lived there for 2-3 years, and then he just decided, no, there's nothing to live for. So then he passed on.
Ying Dok Hay died in 1952. He and Long An were so respected as community members, they are the only frontier Chinese in Grant County, Oregon, with actual markers on their graves.
We're here at Rest Lawn Cemetery, and actually it's in the city limits. I feel like Dok Hay and Long An are old friends. Long An died 1940, he born 1863. Then Dok Hay died in 1952, and he was born in 1862.
Carolyn Meisenheimer personally saw to it that the graves were restored. Their tombstones stand beside the graves of Ed Waugh's parents.
As far as I know, this is the only two recognized or four recognized graves Chinese in Grant County. There are eight unmarked graves here with no record of them. And part of it is when I talk to people about them, they think the fact that there is no record of a name or anything, perhaps they were Chinese.
Yao Wai Gok Han Samwa.
The frontier is lined with the unmarked graves of Chinese who helped to mine gold or build railroads. The Kamwa Chung and the story of Ying Hei and Long An stands as one of the rare testaments to the contribution Chinese immigrants made to early frontier life.
The important lesson, then, is to see these people as individuals. Now, we can see their lives as tragic. There are times when I think of Long An and Dok Hay sitting in that dark Kamwa Chung building, kerosene lighting, until well into the 1940s. We can see them as sort of the isolated, dying remnants of Chinese culture, if we wish, and that's sad. But on the other hand, we have to see their lives against the options that were available to them in China, and also in terms of the images that they created for themselves. They became Ying Hei and Long An. Who were they when they were home alone talking to each other? I really don't know. I see them as men who came out of a terribly difficult environment into another equally challenging environment and totally mastered it. And for me, it's hard to see them as anything other than incredibly successful. In a quiet way, kind of heroes, not kind of stand up and shoot it out heroism, but heroism that comes to learn a foreign culture and a language and adapt to foreign ways. I don't see them as victims at all.
The story of Dok Hay, Frontier Herbalist by Dime Roberts. Special thanks to the Kamwa Chung and Company Museum and the Oregon Parks Trust. This story was produced with funding by the Oregon Council for the Humanities and the Regional Arts and Culture Council.
You've just heard an excerpt from the 8-Hour Crossing East series narrated by George Takei. Music by Cantonese Folk Music Society of San Francisco and Wong Onyuan. Crossing East won the Peabody Award in 2007 and was funded by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This was a special station studio presentation for Asian American Heritage Month. If you want to hear the complete Crossing East series, you can order the CD set or downloads at crossingeast.org. You can listen to this excerpt online later today at stageandstudio.org or on our iTunes podcast. And don't forget to find the Stage and Studio Facebook page where you can get weekly updates on the show. That's it for Stage and Studio this week. Next week, I feature Bass Roots Theater and the poetry of Langston Hughes. Till then, I'm Dime Roberts.
Carter Coles, On the Wall.
An exploration of the effects of nuclear technology on the Pacific Northwest and the world.
Carter Coles, On the Wall.
An exhibit of art, literary works, science, and historical memorabilia that describes the human and environmental impact of the Hanford Nuclear Reservation.
Particles on the Wall.
May 3rd through June 14th, second floor gallery in the EcoTrust building.
Particles on the Wall.
Co-sponsored by Oregon Physicians for Social Responsibility and KBOO Community Radio.
Particles on the Wall.
Information can be found online at kboo.fm on the right-hand side of the page under Community Events. KBOO Community Radio and Proper Villain Productions are co-sponsoring the 4th annual Portland's Prom, the prom you wish you'd had, where the punch will already be spiked and curfew extends past midnight. Portland's Prom will happen on Saturday, May 18th, at the Star Theater in Portland. Doors open at 8:30 p.m. This event is a benefit for Planned Parenthood. Participants must be 21 plus. Entertainment is provided by Just People, Excellent Gentlemen, Worth, and Dimitri. More information can be found online at kboo.fm on the right-hand side of the page under Community Events.
I'm Joseph Gallivan, and this is Art Focus on KBOO Radio. This week our guest is Diane Durston. She's the Arlene Schnitzer Curator of Culture, Art, and Education at the Portland Japanese Garden. Diane and her colleagues have put together a show of the work of Isamu Noguchi, the Japanese-American sculptor. The work includes stone and bronze sculptures, as well as some furniture and lighting designs. The show is called We Are the Landscape of All We Know, and it's at the Japanese Garden until July 21st of this year. Welcome, Diane. It's lovely to have you here at KBOO.
It's a pleasure to be here, Joseph. Thank you.
So, Noguchi, a lot of people just know him for the coffee table. He was a lot more than that, but you have the coffee table. So what does it look like?
The coffee table is a marvelous piece of industrial design. It has a thick glass top with the signature of the artist inscribed on the side, and has wooden legs that are folding underneath. He designed it in the 1940s, and it's been in production ever since with the Herman Miller Company. Ours was donated to us by Design Within Reach here in Portland, and it's still purchasable through them, I believe. The lanterns that he made, he's also famous for making paper lamps. They're called Akari. And people may have seen them, or seen knockoffs, I should say, at places like IKEA, the paper lanterns of different shapes and sizes. The prototypes for that kind of innovation in lantern design were done by Noguchi in the early 1950s. He had gone to Japan multiple times in his life, and he met with people in the town of Gifu, famous for making traditional lanterns, and they were having problems after World War II with finding people who wanted to buy the traditional lanterns. So Noguchi offered to help them kind of do a modern take on them, and he developed some amazingly innovative designs of hanging lanterns, that, and we have several of them on view at the garden.
So those may be some people's only exposure to Noguchi's work, but you have an awful lot more there. You have the pavilion, which is a beautiful wooden room, and that has multiple pieces, probably two dozen.
Mm-hmm.
And then outside, What do you have outside?
We have five large-scale stone and one metal piece of sculpture that sit on the overlook with a view of Mount Hood in the distance. It's very striking. It's a wonderful place to start seeing the exhibition, to sit down on our veranda, look out at the city, and get a sense of Noguchi through those sculptures.
And these are mainly stone that's been carved.
Yes.
Partly left natural on some facets and then sometimes carved and polished.
Yes. Noguchi always said that he kept going back to Japan because that's where he could be close to nature. And I think throughout his life in his sculpture, he always tried to use the natural qualities of the stone, let the stone be a stone, and use as little manipulation or intervention as he could to still show the hand of and the mind of a man.
Mm-hmm. One of them, the one towards the left, it looks like a kind of a diamond shape with different facets to it.
Yes, it's called Reentry Cone, and he did that in the 60s around the time of the heyday of the space program. He connected with social issues and movements of the day, and it's in the shape of a reentry cone of a satellite. So it's made of red granite, quite a beautiful piece.
And it's hollow.
Yes, it is. It's actually three pieces that he put together. He did a lot of constructions with stone as well as carving of stone. Perhaps influenced by work in Japan with paper.
So. Right. And inside there is one, it looks like a kind of big white, roundish, ovalish stone with very precise lines cut into it.
Yes.
It looks like a puzzle.
Yes. I believe you're referring to the piece that appears to be a figure wrapped in a white cloth. He did sculpture that was representational early in his life because he had facility for it, and it helped him earn a living to do sculpture.